Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Mary Roach, who reads from and discusses her new book, Bonk, The Curious Coupling of Science and Sex, published by W.W. Norton. In the weeks to come, we have Elizabeth George, Lee Fanger, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Tattered Cover. It's wonderful to see such a great turnout and a lot of enthusiasm for Mary Roach and her new book. So she's going to be speaking to us tonight, and some of the things I've learned since she graduated in 81, she's been kind of an evolution of her interests. And one of the things I learned, which I think speaks to her curiosity, she loves to watch parasites that attach themselves to the eyeballs of fish. So she's going to talk to us tonight some about this new book, and then be willing to answer some questions and sign some books if you'd like. So let's welcome her.
Okay, but the great thing about those parasites is that in exchange for sucking life from the eyeballs of the fish, they lead the fish around. So even though they've blinded the fish, they lead the fish around. So that was what actually appealed to me about this particular parasite, that it was this lovely relationship that they had. Anyway, I'm really happy to be here and not where I was a couple of nights ago. I was down in Miami and doing a talk down there, and my in-laws came to the reading. And I don't know how familiar you are with the book, but there's a scene that involves my husband, and my in-laws don't know about that scene. And I normally talk about that scene in the talk. So I was able to, by carefully positioning myself and people in the audience, I was able to kind of hide them from my view and pretend that they weren't actually there. Anyway, so this book is a book about sex research, and it's very specifically about, can you all hear good? You're all good. It's about physiological sex research, like the stuff that goes on in laboratories. And I was drawn to this because I thought it was just this wonderful and surreal combination of something that is, on the one hand, very, very personal and intimate and private, and on the other hand, physiology and anatomy, and something that is worth studying in a lab. And the challenges of doing that are fascinating. I got interested in this when I came across a reference to the films that Masters and Johnson had made, and these are no ordinary films. They were made using essentially a penis camera. They had made this phallus with a little tiny camera and a light source, and they attached it to a motor housing so that it would go like this. And they were actually filming what was happening to the woman's sexual organs from the inside. And that is, on the one hand, sort of this brilliant, innovative, marvelously imaginative solution to a research challenge. On the other hand, something that just made them seem very, very strange. And so I thought right away when I read about that, sex research has to be the next book. And so it was. And I kind of pitched it to my editor saying, well, in my usual way, I'll sort of go on the scene and I'll go to the labs and I'll hang out and watch what's going on. And they said, sure, that sounds great. And then I called up some of these places and I said, yeah, I'm working on a book. And I thought I'd just come down and observe, and which marks me as a really strange individual. especially in the case the one instance where I did actually, what the researchers would invariably end up saying is, well, really the only way I could see that you're going to be able to make this work is if you yourself are a subject. And in one case, I dragged my husband into it. It was this study in London. It was it's this new imaging technique, diagnostic technique. It's four-dimensional ultrasound. In other words, it's like this four-dimensional image of a body part or parts. And it's a moving picture. So, and this guy had a paper published in Lancet, and he made reference to at some point wanting to actually film human intercourse. And I wrote to him and I said, you know, I'd really like to be there at this historic undertaking and, you know, see what's going on in your lab. And this is what he wrote back. Dear Ms. Roach, you're welcome to interview me in London. However, to arrange a new inaction, this was his euphemism for it, would be very difficult, mainly due to the difficulty in recruiting volunteers. If your organization is able to recruit brave couple for intimate study, I would be happy to arrange it. So my organization gave it some thought. My organization called its husband. I said, you know, honey, how you said you haven't been to Europe in 25 years. So I offered to, pay for everything. I took him out to a really expensive restaurant afterward. I did everything I could, and still I owe him a favor for the rest of his life. I don't want to give it all away because there's a little discreet and carefully worded scene in the book. But it was really a very, people say, well, how could you possibly, do that? Because ultrasound, if anyone who's been pregnant knows, it's the guy is right there holding the wand. You know, you're not, if it's an MRI tube, you would be able to have a little privacy. But not so ultrasound. And so there's the guy, Dr. Deng, in his white lab coat. And we're sort of standing there in our really dorky Johnny tops. They had us put on those little hospital Johnnies, which are really not an attractive thing to wear. And really, it was kind of that same surreal scenario they get. You go to a hospital and you're going to have some procedure done. You don't really know what you're in for, but you know you're going to have to get through it. It's going to take about 20 minutes. And, you go to the doctor and he might say something like, well, now I'll be inserting my gloved finger in your rectum. And you go, okay. Because that's just the kind of thing that happens when you go to the doctor. I was actually taking notes the entire time. Every man's nightmare. I found that actually even with your pants on, that sex research or researching a book about sex was afforded endless opportunities for embarrassment. The thing that I always stumbled over was that I would I got a lot of books and journal articles from interlibrary loan, which means you send in a little request and then it goes to their computer and then they let you know when either the journal article or the book has arrived and you go and you give them your card and you pick it up. And in my head, I'm picturing the entire file, Mary Roach file there, going back to Stiff where you had, the principles and practice of embalming, the chemistry of death, gunshot injuries. I mean, all these like incredibly macabre and morose things. And then it would shift suddenly and you'd have stuff like phantom erection after amputation of penis. And sexual intercourse as a potential treatment for intractable hiccups. This was a paper where this guy actually had hiccups for days and days and found that when he had sex with his wife, that lo and behold, he was cured. And the authors of the paper went on to advise unattached hiccupers that they might try masturbation. I just love that there was an actual segment of the population that you could refer to as unattached hiccupers. The book is, if you're familiar with Stiff, it's a similar kind of tone. It's sort of like Stiff, but with warm bodies, because it's all these things going on in a lab that you're just not expecting to be going on in a lab. And there's lots of footnotes. There's actually double the number of footnotes that there were in Stiff, because people would always write to me and say, oh, footnotes are my favorite part. So I thought, all right, I'll give these people what they want. There's like a footnote on every single page. I drive people to distraction. I'm going to actually read one of the footnotes to you, because footnotes are short and fun. And this is one of my favorites. It has to do, well, actually, it's not, we don't really need to get into what it has to do with. Trust me, there's a reason why I came across this journal article. Anyway, the journal article is called Rectal Foreign Bodies, colon being the punctuation. Rectal Foreign Bodies, Case Reports and a Comprehensive Review of the World's Literature. And it includes this list of objects that doctors have had to remove from rectums over the years. And I presented some of the highlights here. We have a bottle of impulse body spray that was, quote, incarcerated. That was the verb. I like that. They used the verb. Incarcerated in a 37-year-old lawyer. The only time they thought it necessary to mention the occupation of the of the person. A parsnip. A plantain, parentheses, with condom. So you never know what you're going to catch from a plantain. A dull knife. A cattle horn, a salami, a jeweler's saw, and a plastic spatula. Multiple holdings in the same rectum are listed under the heading collections. These include several that could pass as still life titles. Oil can with potato, two apples, 402 stones, and several they probably could not pass as still life titles. Umbrella handle and enema tubing, lemon and cold cream jar, and one that suggests a quiet evening in the Biltmore. Spectacles, suitcase key, tobacco pouch, and magazine. Yeah. So, anyway, on a little more serious note, sex research, when I mentioned to people what the topic of the book was, I tended to get this funny reaction. People would say, you know, tell me something I don't know. Why are people studying the physiology of sex? There was this sort of sense that if I know how to do it, what more could there be to learn? And I was actually surprised to find that there's some fairly basic stuff that isn't known, and that some daring and innovative researchers are trying to figure out. For example, there's a guy at Emory University who's gotten interested in the anatomical differences in women, the distance between the clitoris and the vagina, and whether that has some impact on whether they have orgasm and intercourse. And the way he found out about it, this is what got me interested. He came across the work of this woman, Marie Bonaparte, who is Napoleon's great-grandniece, and she had been someone who was very frustrated with her sex life. She never had an orgasm when she had sex with her husband. She became convinced that her clitoris was too distant and that was the problem. She actually brought 243, and this is like in the 19-teens, 20s, a long time ago. She brought women into the lab. She didn't really have a lab. I thought maybe her parlor. I'm not sure where she did it. But she measured the distance in 243 women, interviewed them about their intimate details of their sexual life, and actually found a correlation. And she became so convinced, and measured herself as well. She discovered that she had a much longer than average span. She called herself, she came up with three different categories of women based on the distance between the two. She herself was a téléclitoridienne, which translates to she of the distant clitoris, which is a much prettier word than frigid, which is the other word they used at the time. And she was an amazing case. She had to have a little bit of the Bonaparte determinism in her, because she actually sought out a surgeon that she knew and had her clitoris surgically relocated. Not like to her elbow, but, you know, it's like closer to her vagina. She had it done twice, and it didn't help her. And so he just wanted to take her aside and say, Marie, try another position. Anyway, she was Marie Bonaparte was... She was a published journal article, but the writing back then was so different than today's medical journal writings. She had this whole passage on, you know, the frustrations of these women who never achieve the ultimate moment of sublime ecstasy. And then she also pointed out in her paper that nature had favored animals, and she gave the example of livestock, the horses and cows, where the clitoris is very close, very, very close. And in pigs, actually, the clitoris is inside the vagina. Vagina, which I thought, you know, somebody, whoever designed pigs had the right idea. Speaking of pigs, this is a good transition. So speaking of pigs, another area of research that you would think science might have figured out the answer already has to do with something called upsuck, which is a fun word to say, and also it's this notion that when a woman has an orgasm, that the contractions pull the semen up through the cervix and present it very quickly to the egg, thus increasing the likelihood of conception. And there is animal data that that backs this up, so much so that in Denmark, The Danish Pork Production Board has come up with a 5-point sow stimulation plan. There's like a 4-color poster with all the different steps. And this, the artificial inseminators, the farmers who do the artificial insemination on the pig farms, actually mimic some of the things that the boar does to arouse the female. And there's a there's also a video that the Pork Production Board was kind enough to send me, and, or stupid enough. And they there's this scene with it. Well, there's actually an extra point on the video that's not on the poster that was deemed to be a little too much for the farmers, where there's this, there's this strapping handsome Dane with blonde hair and a white lab coat, and he's lying down on the back, chest down on the back of the sow, reaching underneath and manipulating her teats, which is something that the boar does actually with his snout, not his hooves. But there's this great moment where right before this starts happening, they, they show his hand and they zero in and they show, it's as though they're trying to show you his wedding ring, like so that, lest you think anything untoward is going to happen between these two. So, you may, Masters and Johnson actually looked into upsuck in human beings, because it was actually hundreds of years ago, it was believed that a woman could not conceive unless she had an orgasm. These were wonderful times to be a woman, because, the physicians would be advising couples, that there was actually a quote in one book I found, this is going back to the Habsburg Empire, that there's a Maria Theresa, who is a member of the royal family and having trouble conceiving, and the court physician was quoted as saying, and God knows where they got this quote, but he is quoted as saying, "I am of the opinion that your most sacred, that the vulva of your most sacred majesty be titillated for some time before intercourse." And she went on to have 18 children. So apparently it worked for Maria Theresa. At Masters and Johnson looked into upsuck. They were upsuck skeptics, which is also fun to say. And they came up with this amazing study. They had a cervical cap that fit over the cervix, and they put inside this simulated semen with a radio opaque material so that it would show up on an X-ray. And they had the woman, install that, and then they put them in front of an X-ray thing and had them masturbate. And then, at the exact moment, they took the X-ray, did not find any upsuck, although other people have criticized the study, saying that the cap would have interfered with the suction. But so there really isn't an answer for sure to whether or not it has upsuck might actually play a role in conception. You may be wondering, how do you make simulated semen in the laboratory? I found actually 3 recipes. My favorite was one that, how on a recipe there'll be a little line that'll say, for example, yield 3, 2 dozen cupcakes. This one said, yield 1 ejaculate. I actually suggested to my publicist that we should maybe do a little cookbook at some point, because in Stiff I have 3 recipes. I have mellified man, placenta pizza, and ballistic gelatin. And in this one we've got, there's the 3 semen recipes and I think a testicle consomme. So I regularly frighten my publicist with my marketing ideas. I told her that I thought we should have done a special collector's edition version of Stiff that would be the scratch and sniff edition. She did not write back. So let's see. The other thing people ask me a lot is, what's the biggest surprise? What are some surprises? What did you come across that we don't already know, or that you didn't already know? And one of them is that I found this wonderful paper, a 1989 paper done by SUNY Downstate, State University of New York, and it was about male multiple orgasm. And they found 21 men who regularly had them, and they interviewed them, and there was some quotes about the men talking about how they had come upon this discovery. And one of them was a skeet shooter, clay pigeon kind of guy. And he said that the way he had figured it out was, one time he had continued thrusting on behalf of his wife, and lo and behold, he had another one, like right after the first one, and he said that he exclaimed, "Doubly," which is a term for shooting 2 clay pigeons with 1 load of shot. Apparently an event even rarer than male multiple orgasm. I tried to verify the term doubly by writing to a skeet shooting organization that I came across on the web. And I said, dear Mr. So-and-so, I'm working on this book, and I have this paper on male multiple orgasm. The guy, da-da-da. No reply. At a certain point, I called up a transgender surgeon once who was, he helps, both directions, but I was asking him, when he's working with men who are becoming women and he's creating they call it a neoclitoris. It's made from a small piece of the frenulum that they put in place. And I said, how close do you place it? And he said, my subjects just want to be normal. We put it about average, which is 1 inch. And I wrote back and said, you really ought to consider putting it a little closer. And he didn't write back. There's a fun chapter in the book on orgasm that I'm not going to go into right now, but I will. I was trying to get a handle on sort of what exactly is it, and is it different in men and women? Is it clitoral versus vaginal? Is it different in some qualitative way? And my favorite explanation, this researcher said, I think of them, they're like scotch. You have blended orgasms and you have single malt. In other words, you can have input just from one stimulus or from part of it being mental, part of it being between the legs, part of it being nipple, whatever, and people are wired so differently, when it comes to orgasm. There are amazing case studies. I came across a case report of a woman who regularly had orgasm whenever she brushed her teeth. She had an orgasm followed by a very small epileptic seizure. And she went to the neurologist, and they were, of course, fascinated by her. And they thought, okay, first, let's see if it's the toothpaste. Maybe it's something in the toothpaste. And they switched out the toothpaste. That wasn't it. They thought maybe it was pressure on her gums. This was in Asia. They pressed on her gums with a chopstick to see if they could make her have an orgasm. That didn't work. Finally determined it was just this complex motor action that she was doing. And there wasn't really anything they could say. And she, sadly, you'd think that she would think this is kind of great. And she'd, number one, have this wonderful little trick. And number two, have like the best oral hygiene in the world. but she believed she was possessed by demons. And there's a line in there saying that she switched to mouthwash for her oral care. It's very sad. I interviewed a woman who it took her 2 years to teach her this, but she can sort of think herself to orgasm. She does this breath work thing. And I was interviewing her at a sushi restaurant, and she said, she was describing how she does it. And I said, could you do it right here? And she said, I'd rather finish eating if you don't mind. But she then said, she would do it outside. There's a bench on the sidewalk outside. And so afterward, we sat out there. There were people walking by, and you wouldn't really know. You'd think maybe she was just sitting there resting because she kind of flushed a little bit and her eyes were shut. You'd have no idea what was going on. It took her a minute. And I said, are you doing this constantly? And she said, did I just say this to you? She just said, when I get home, I'm too tired. But she said that the last time she had done it was on the Disneyland tram. But I don't know why. But anyway, the second thing I wanted to read to you is another footnote. And this one I like because it really is a nice example of some of the challenges of being a sex researcher. It can be difficult to get funding. It can be difficult to convince people to be your subject. And it can even be difficult to present your findings to your peers. And by way of example, I'm going to read this one footnote. And this footnote is dedicated to my friend Dave, who has showed up. I haven't seen Dave since 1981. Dave is a urologist. And this footnote has to do with a urologist named Giles Brindley. And you probably know what it's about. In a 1983 urology conference, Brindley delivered a lecture about a new impotency drug, papaverine, that produced robust erections when injected directly into the penis. He began by showing his audience a group of around 80 urologists and their wives, many en route to the conference cocktail party and dressed in formal attire, a series of slides of his own penis after various dosages. He then revealed that 5 minutes earlier, he had injected himself with papaverine. He pulled the fabric of his tracksuit tightly against his hips to reveal the outline of his medicated member. Not satisfied, he then pulled down his pants, revealing, in the words of eyewitness Lawrence Klotz, quote, a long, thin, clearly erect penis. Klotz's account of the event was published in British Journal of Urology International in 2005. And then we have a continuation of Dr. Klotz's description. Brindley paused, seeming to ponder his next move. The sense of drama in the room was palpable. He then said with gravity, I'd like to give some of the audience the opportunity to confirm the degree of tumescence. With his pants at his knees, he waddled down the stairs. As he approached the audience, erection waggling before him, four or five of the women in the front rows threw their arms in the air and screamed. The scream seemed to shock Professor Brindley, who rapidly pulled up his trousers and terminated the lecture. And at that point, I'm going to terminate mine. Thanks.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fodum. We have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for Elizabeth George, Lee Fenger, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on May 2nd, 2008.